This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you till 2 p.m. You've probably wondered as you've listened to recent programs what's happened to KVMR's worldwide stable of correspondents. We have people scouring the four corners of the earth to find good reading material for us. There's John Dederich in Camptonville, there's Aaron Rodgers in Brooklyn, Siddhartha Lokanandi in Mumbai, and you haven't heard from any of them in quite a long time. So today, we're going to actually catch up on that and give you two of them, Aaron from Brooklyn and Siddhartha, not from Mumbai, but from Manhattan, which is almost the same thing, I think. And we're going to talk with Aaron first for maybe 30 or 40 minutes, and then I'll give Siddhartha a call and see what's on his mind. So hi, Aaron.
Hi, Eric. How are you?
Pretty well, thanks. Aaron, you have, I would say to our listeners that they haven't heard that voice in quite some time, but I did a couple of weeks ago when Aaron was in town, and we got talking about some reading. She suggested four books she was going at. I said, well, I'll read the same four, and then we can talk about them. But as listeners may also know, Aaron is a teacher in Brooklyn, and the school year is coming up, so before we get to the books, I'd like to find out a little bit about what you're expecting to do in school this year and whether the four books you chose have anything to do with your teaching.
Oh, well, this year I'm sort of feeling myself. I hear from down the pipe some other teachers that have been at it a long time who taught the sixth graders that will now be my seventh graders tell me that they're the worst group that they've ever had. So I think that the books that I've chosen, I think mostly, if they have anything to do with it, I think they have to do with me indulging my own literary taste to kind of suck the last drops of my freedom before I have to deal with the fire starters and the desk humpers that I think I'm going to be dealing with when the year begins.
I remember a year or so ago, one of the books that we actually talked about was Balthazar Gracian's Art of Worldly Wisdom, which you actually were going to use in your class. I thought that was a very strange book, but if people want to find out about that, they can go back to that program. And I think we have more than enough to talk about with your new books. I think I'll just mention the four titles and then I'll ask you questions about them one by one.
Sure.
In the order that I have them sitting next to me, I'll go in the order in which I think we might discuss them. The first is Cesar Ayra, the Argentinian writer, his short novel called Ghosts. Then John Barth's Chimera, which is three novellas on sort of mythological themes. Then John Berger, you were reading From A to X, and I couldn't find that, but I got one called G, which I thought fit in the same range, about a third of the way through. And finally, Joan Didion's Where I Was From. I think we should start with Cesar Ayra, because I knew nothing about him when I picked up this book, except that he was Argentinian and that it had good blurbs on the back, although one of them was from Roberto Bolaño, once you've started reading Ayra, you don't want to stop. And Mark Doty said, Ayra is firmly in the tradition of Jorge Luis Borges and W.G. Sebald.
Yeah, which seems is, like...
Go ahead.
which seems like it's a better recommendation than the first one. I thought the Bologna quote, I have the same copy, and I thought the Bologna quote is sort of, doesn't say a whole lot about the book. I mean, it recommends them because I, Roberto Bologna, I guess, has garnered a lot of cred, but you don't want to stop thing doesn't do much justice to the book itself.
I'd like to talk a little bit first about the book and then about the writer and his technique, which I found out only later on after I'd finished it. Ghosts is a story of really an afternoon on New Year's Eve, a luxury apartment building that's being constructed in Buenos Aires. And it sort of jumps from character to character and then finally settles on one and on her interaction with the ghosts who are inhabiting the building.
Correct. As you said, Ira is an Argentinian writer, but the family that he focuses on are Chilean. They're, Raul Vinas is the super of the building. He's the one that's taking care of the half-finished building while it's being prepared for the new residents. And one of the things that I found sort of interesting about this is that, you know, and it might be a sort of theme that we can talk about throughout, definitely through the Berger that we'll talk about later in the Didion, is that this really self and country critical position that he takes. Almost everything that he has to say about Argentinians in the novel is sort of critical or negative, and the Chileans are the ones that really come out through the story, that the family, to be human and important enough to go into.
Now, that's one of the things I could not decide as I was reading the book, how much to take him seriously, and how much he was either giving out popular stereotypes or maybe just indulging in them himself. Because do Argentinians really think that Chileans are that different from them? And do Chileans think Argentinians are that different? I have no idea.
Yeah, and I don't necessarily either. I actually had, it was a strange coincidence, in California, we had a Chilean here watching the house and hanging out with the dog. He's an artist who lives in Santiago, and he, I tried to kind of pick his brain, his name is Frankie, about this, because I felt like it was sort of important to the novel, and I couldn't figure out whether Ira, it was seriously criticizing Argentinians, or if he was playing, as I think that he kind of plays through the novel with the reader. And Frankie was very, sort of like the Chileans in the book, was sort of demure about confirming or denying it. So I took it to be that most portraits were at least somewhat accurate. I mean, there is a whole scene where the women, the Chilean women, go downstairs and they're grocery shopping, and they see an Argentinian woman pass them by in the street. And she's sort of described as this almost Amazonian, tall, muscular, heavily made up, tanned, artificial.
Short-skirted.
Say again?
Short-skirted.
Yes.
Large-breasted.
Yes. Kind of artificial, rigid woman. And the Chilean women, I guess you are to infer that they're smaller and not so heavily made up or short-skirted, are noticing her, and they say you can always tell when an Argentinian woman is married. Now, they don't go on to explain what that means, except for that I assume that this one was not married, and that there's some major transformation that the Chilean women think that they go through. And I asked Frankie about that, and he just sort of laughed in kind of recognizing what was being talked about it. But obviously, I don't think that could be spread all across and made true for everybody. But I do think that that Iris is serious about criticizing his countrymen and women. I think that that's something that he's interested in, at least in a partial way.
And he definitely does not seem too fond of the rich.
No, definitely not. I mean, and he's, it's not, I mean, we'll talk about Virgil later because this comes up definitely with him, but it doesn't seem like a passionate sort of hatred. It doesn't feel like a polemical novel at all to me. But it's definitely, you definitely get the impression that this, the luxury building that's being built for not just Argentinian rich folks, but also international people that are coming to settle there, you definitely get the impression that their lives aren't as interesting or vital as the Chileans who are poor or the workers who are putting the building together. I mean, so you can kind of infer that where his interests lie and who he thinks make interesting literary characters.
And it's interesting that he refers to the construction workers, whom he calls builders, as being poor, not working class, not underclass or anything like that, but just out and out poor. And that may be the situation in Argentina. Nonetheless, they seem to have a very substantial life. And a very loving life.
Yeah. You get a sense of, especially because of he chooses the New Year's Day as the setting. So you get a chance to see them in a day that might not be exactly your typical work day. They're going to take the day off a little bit earlier. They have a really elaborate barbecue lunch. That makes my lunch hour look pretty poor, and you can really sense that they listen to each other. They tell each other these bawdy stories. They have all these nicknames for one another. Their lives are definitely interesting to the reader.
Now it starts out. At first, I thought it was going to deal with the rich people, because those are the first ones described. Then I thought I was going to deal with various of the builder's family members, and then it began to center really on the one young girl, Patri, and on the ghosts.
Yeah, and I found that strange, too. I mean, it's almost, I guess, halfway through the book where you really find that Patri is the character of interest. She has that fabulous dream about architecture that allows Ira to go on and on and on about all these theories of social patterns and architecture, and she's also the one who, you don't get a ton of her interior thought, but she's definitely the focus, and obviously the focus of the end of the novel. But I think that, I'd be curious what you think, but as I was reading, I was wondering again, you know, maybe with the same way that I was wondering if he was being seriously critical of Argentinians or if he was kind of making fun. I didn't know if he meant to. Patrick seems to have kind of a raw deal in the novel. She's older than all the other children. She comes from her mother's previous marriage. And she ends up having to, like, chase all the little kids down, and the little kids kind of do whatever they want, and they run wild all over this empty building. And she keeps having to go and bring them back, and they get ice cream, and she has to stay and wash. And I couldn't tell if she kind of turned to the ghosts because nobody else was really paying much attention to her, or if it was just sort of incidental. I didn't know what to take from that. I don't know what you think about that.
We don't have too much time to talk, so I'm going to jump to some things I read about Ira afterwards, and that they sort of made more sense out of what was there than what I got from reading it. And I will say that in reading it, I was particularly puzzled by some of his digressions. Some of them were very short, but some of them were, like the one about essentially the anthropology of architecture, were quite long. In some cases, they were very illuminating, and in some cases, like the architecture one, I thought there was a lot of disinformation in there. I didn't think everything he was saying was correct. Mm-hmm. But be that as it may, I later found out that he is a very prolific writer, that he writes short books, and that what he likes to do is sit down for an hour or so every day if possible, or whenever he can, and write a page or a page and a half, and then stop. And apparently he took Hemingway's advice that a writer should stop when he still has something to say and not when they've run out of ideas. And so he would stop at a certain point, but the next day when he picked up, I think he would continue on the same page and would not necessarily have thought about what he was going to write in between. And that makes some sense out of some of the swerves that the book takes. I have a feeling that he didn't necessarily know at the end, at the beginning, how it was going to end.
Right. Yeah, I did some of my own reading on him as well, and there is a sense that he in an interview he said he didn't really like to look back so much. He liked to sort of continue to move forward. And I think that probably does account for how Patry sort of in the end emerges as the principal character. It's almost as if he starts with the scene of the building and the builders and the people who are coming in, and allows you know, the story to kind of take its own form. And I think the effect, it does have this effect of you're not sure how much to take seriously and how much is just sort of a whim that came into his mind. But I do think that there are passages that are pretty lovely.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of that, it's sort of a light, fast read. There are times when I find it quite lovely.
Yes, I completely agree, and especially once Patry becomes the main character.
Yeah.
Let's move on to John Berger or Berger. I've heard both pronunciations from Americans and English. A person who knew him says Berger. Other
okay.
people say Berger, but I do not know. Anyway, he's very well known as a not only as a novelist, but as an art critic and as a strong social activist, a Marxist with very strong views on modern capitalist society. And I read his first or one of his very first novels, G, which won the Booker Prize back 30-some years ago. And you read what's probably his latest?
Yeah, From A to X is the latest as far as I can tell. It came out hardcover in 2008 and will be, I think it's in paperback now, maybe just after the spring. So yeah, it is his most recent.
So, and what I had read of his previously, two books that I greatly admire, the first one I have reread is called Ways of Seeing, which is on sort of what you can tell about a society from looking at its art.
Right.
And his book, The Success and Failure of Picasso, which I'm not a huge Picasso fan, but he's one of those fascinating people who's just, he's there and you have to come to grips with him. And I think Berger does a fantastic job of explaining especially his social background. So I was looking forward very much to reading G, but I haven't read From A to X, so why don't you talk about that first?
Well, I guess I'll say that I came to From A to X. I had heard of Ways of Seeing. It was a text that is assigned where I went to school. A lot of Parsons School of Design students read it, and I have a lot of friends who have read it, so that I was familiar with. Other than that, I really had no experience of Berger, and so a couple of months ago, Siddhartha gave me From A to X. Siddhartha was working at Verso at the time, where it's published, and so I didn't really have any pretext to it. I just started reading it, and I think that it's probably one of my favorite books that I've read in at least definitely the past year and maybe even more. It is the story of a woman, Aida, who is writing letters to her jailed lover Xavier, and you don't know if those names are actual or if they have been adopted because they're trying to camouflage themselves from a kind of unnamed oppressive regime. And there are those two strains, the sort of oppressive regime and then the love story between that Aieta brings to life through her letters, serve as sort of this fabulous structural tension in the novel, where part of it is, as a reader, you're looking for clues and trying to figure out where these people live and why they are oppressed and why he has been jailed. And then on the other hand, you're just really enjoying. Aieta is an incredibly intelligent and observant character. She's a pharmacist, so she has all these sort of scientific observations that she makes, and is very involved in the community as a pharmacist. All these people are coming in and needing her attention. And so there, as I was reading reviews in preparation to talk about this, some reviewers come down on the side of it's too polemical, and basically it comes down to just a disagreeing with Berger's politics, which certainly comes through in the book. But for me, although the whole book is kind of permeated by the political, it's really just a very lyrical love story through these one-sided letters. Xavier never writes back. He's in prison. We don't get those letters, so we just get her. And so I think that even if you're not a Marxist, and you find yourself even at great odds with Berger, that this is a novel that you could enjoy strictly on its literary merits, because it's very, very beautiful.
Okay, now I will jump to G and tell you that the first thing anybody should know about John Berger is that he is an amazingly good writer.
Yeah.
He knows how to put one word after another in a way that really catches you. And this is quite obvious in his... I just picked up the Picasso book, which I read maybe 2 years ago, and immediately wanted to read it again. It draws you in so completely. G is a novel that is written in very short sections in which the author is constantly jumping in to talk about his relation to the characters and what is possible to say and what you can't say. It almost seems like an early example of what we now call metafiction. Once I've said that, I realize that all the books that you picked, in a way, fit this category, because all of them have the authors jumping in and talking about their own writing or the characters they're dealing with, this and that. And Berger does it amazingly well at times, but he is treading the line very, very closely between precision, I think, and pretentiousness. Mm. And when I first started reading it, I was definitely convinced he was on the precision side. And I began to compare him unfavorably with a couple of other authors who, both Canadian poets, and I'm wondering if, you know, do English novelists have a Booker Prize winners have a special impact on Canadian poets, who have caught this pattern of taking characters, sort of flashlighting, you know, almost strobe lighting them. The light comes on and off in different positions, and you jump from one exotic locale to another. For instance, G takes place in Livorno, in Milan, in the Alps, in England, in an English, also a little bit in London and Paris, and in an English country manor. The descriptions are lovingly exact and luminous. But I sometimes think he's just caught up so much in the glory of his descriptive ability or his ability to manipulate his characters that he doesn't really control where he's going. As I said, I think he's still on the precision side. The two people who went on to to the other side, and I think have lost it completely, are Michael Ondaatje and Ann Carson. And I found that I read Ann Carson's autobiography of Red, which is nominally poetry in that the lines have big white space between them, but could just as well be prose. And it similarly highlights one particular situation in a very weird life, and then another, and then jumps 20 years, and they're in another country, and there's a couple of scenes. One of them is on the top of an apartment building where people are squatting, sort of like the people, the workers in Ghosts. And she does it beautifully. It makes me want to go to South America and find that particular apartment building. But I think she's completely caught up just with her own descriptive ability. And at a certain point, I can't take it too seriously. And I haven't finished G. And I am beginning to get that same reaction. I'm not. Before I came in, I was going to say, well, it was a nice try. And, but I'm getting old. I have to pick how I'm going to spend 3 or 4 hours of my life, and or in this case, probably 6 or 7 hours. And is this the way I want to spend it? When I picked it up just now and opened the page where I was and just looked at 2 or 3 sentences, I was again caught up by the sheer writerly ability. And so I don't know what I'm going to do, whether I'm going to go on or not.
I think that from A to X, I know what you mean about his interjections. I read lots of criticism about that, people that were annoyed about that sort of intellectual hubris. But one of the things about From A to X that I would recommend it to you because of is that because his character is a woman and is so different from who Berger is, he interrupts once at the beginning of the novel to introduce himself as John Berger, this man who has recuperated these packets of Aida's letters and has felt the need to reprint them. And that's the only interruption that you have from anyone named John Berger or even approaching, resembling him. And so I think you get all of the really, really great writing that Berger aims to do so easily. I mean, anything that he describes, shelling beans, dogs running around, she goes on to this, talking about the way that the pharmacy is laid out and organized. Anything that he chooses to describe through Aida becomes vivid and imbued with all kinds of really important human meaning without having any of the interruption of sort of the intellectual, political writer. And I, for that reason, I would say if G starts to go downhill for you, pick up From A to X, and you will not run into that problem whatsoever.
And he sticks with two characters and one
Correct.
Situation, whereas G is chronological but jumps all over the place with huge gaps in between.
Yes.
Okay. I think the one person we both completely agree on, or the one book, is Joan Didion's Where I Was From. You uh-huh. said you thought it should be required reading for any Californian who has ever bemoaned change.
Yes. Although there's this, as soon as I said that, I think I said it to you when I was in California, that I thought it should be required reading. I think 2 or 3 days after I finished up a couple of pages, and she says, she has this quote about how it's one more proof that assigned reading accomplishes nothing. So I don't think that Joan Didion would agree with me that making it assigned reading would have any positive or negative effect. But I still think that any Californian who is thought either privately or spoken to friends or family about, this place is changed and it's changed for the worse, I think would benefit from the sort of acerbic, look that she takes at the the mythology that's kind of grown around California and being a Californian, and these ideas that Californians have about themselves and about their state. And I think that it's good medicine for, I mean, it's certainly good medicine for me here in New York. There are lots of times where I've missed and felt very nostalgic for California. And, you know, my family, my father's side of the family had ranches, avocado ranches down in the South. So they talked a lot about, you know, how Redondo Beach changed or how the farms disappeared, and my grandmother too. I grew up hearing all of these stories about how people just aren't the same, and between immigration and land development and suburbanization, California has sort of gone to the dogs or whatever, and Joan Didion grew up thinking that way as well, and then she
essentially decided it had been to the dogs in the beginning.
Yes, that it has always been that, and that Californians have been first in line to allow that to happen, to whether it was selling off land or speculating on land or towards the end, I just reread the stuff about
insane asylums.
Yes, and if I could just read a bit, because it really gives a clear sense of the view she takes. She is reading from Richard W. Fox's 1978 study, So Far Disordered in Mind and Sanity in California from 1870 to 1930. California had a higher rate of commitment for insanity than any other state in the nation. A disproportion most reasonably explained, Fox suggests, by the zeal with which California state officials sought to locate, detain, and treat not only those considered mentally ill, but also a wide variety of other deviants, including all kinds of people, some of whom were put in detention from their neighbors. People calling and saying, my sister hasn't been going out, she's not taking care of her appearance, she's not knitting, she's not, you know. What was arresting in this pattern of commitment was the extent to which it diverged from the California sense of itself as loose, less socially rigid than the rest of the country, more adaptable and more tolerant of difference. And she talks not just about how people were forcibly put into asylum for various reasons, including old age, intemperance, was that they were also the forced sterilization of those who were committed. And it's just, I was so, this book is so important to me. It's very helpful as an antidote to sort of this feeling that something has been taken away from me as Californian by change or by immigration or any of the other things that seem to be such a common part of the conversation.
Now, Joan Didion was born in Sacramento, went east to work as a writer, came back and lived in Southern California for many years, and finally returned to New York. Along the way, she's written several novels, especially Run River, which takes place north of Sacramento, and Play It As It Lays, which takes place in basically on the LA freeways, and books of essays, Slouching Toward Bethlehem and the White Album. I always found in the essays more fascinating than the novels, and particularly what she wrote about her childhood in Sacramento, about living near the governor's mansion, about the California Water Project. She writes very personally, but also very analytically about things like water projects.
Yeah.
And this is a book I've always wanted to read since it came out about 5 years, 6 years ago, and I'm so glad I did. But as an Easterner, as I grew up, I was born probably 20 miles from where she lives, just outside New York City. Didn't come here permanently till I was 21, and I'm not leaving. I mean, I don't like the changes either, but this is where I'm to, sort of, as opposed to where she was from. I think she maybe just couldn't handle the tension of trying to justify herself either positively or negatively with the changes. And also, her husband died suddenly, and I think she probably feels less ambiguous. I guess that's it. In New York, you know that things are going to be harsh and impersonal, and there's nothing you can do about it, and so no point in kidding yourself.
Yeah. I mean, she also talks about how, you know, her ancestors are part of what she calls the Great Crossing, people that came east west from the east in wagons and got stuck at the Donner Pass and she talks about them having to leave behind their silver hairbrushes and their hope chests and their mother's dogwood. And I think one of the things that at least seems to me to have informed her comfort in the east, aside from what I think you rightly point out being personal, is that her tastes were simply more aligned here.
With all the things that the crossing people left behind.
Yes, yeah, and she talks about how, you know, even though her family prided itself on this great spirit of independence and you kill the rattlesnake and you move on kind of stuff, she grew up in a household full of old curtains and beautiful furniture, all of which had been either sent back from the East or had been modeled on the taste of the sort of urban Victorian aesthetic that is rooted here. And I think that, you know, her coming back east was a kind of simple matter of taste in some ways, and then the conflict of the identity that she had been raised to take on, and she even talks about being, I think, graduating from fifth grade maybe and having to make a speech about the great state of California.
And, well, she wrote it, and she was quite proud of it.
Yeah.
And it was only later that she begins to see that she at that point had fallen into a lot of the myths that she now deplores.
Yes, yeah. And I think it's a really interesting. I mean, I know that I know that a lot of novelists and writers in general, it must be very difficult to look back, especially when you've had a long and public career, to look back at things that you've written. But she is. In this book, really, really willing to look back. She treats her novel as if it were not her own in terms of her ability to critique the notions that were swimming around her mind when she wrote it. And that's just one of the things that I love about the book.
Okay, if I'm going to call Siddhartha, we've got to
finish
up pretty quickly. Sure. So, John Barth's Kimura, you. I'll give your description from it. You say it's like a pornographic soap opera that's been squeezed into 1001 Nights and classic mythology. Fun, smart reading.
Yeah, and I think that we could almost just leave it at that. This book came to me by way of an anthology called Postmodern American Fiction that's put together by Norton. And I first read he takes the younger sister of, I'm not gonna, can I pronounce it right, Scheherazade?
Scheherazade is the older one.
Yes, and Dunyazad?
That's what I would say. If it's Scheherazade, it must be Dunyazad.
Yeah, and so she takes, he takes her as his principal storyteller. She's the one that was sitting at the foot of the bed while Scheherazade was telling the story. And keeping the king from killing her, and but makes these tales, both 1001 Nights and tales of Perseus and Medusa, and makes them very, very bawdy and very, very fun, but also does a lot of really, I think, astute examinations of adult relationships and what happens when a marriage that sustained you for 20 years suddenly completely falls apart, and what happens when siblings don't get along, takes these sort of quotidian situations and really imbues them, the relationship between the myth and the sex and the real life, I find to be really invigorating reading. I love this book.
And I couldn't get through it.
Oh.
And I don't have too much to say, and I'm going to give it another try because he is a lot of fun. 30 years or so ago, I read Barth's first two novels, The Floating Opera and End of the Road, which I liked very much, especially The End of the Road, which is, they're both funny and a bit extravagant, but the situation in End of the Road is really quite searing. I can't remember too much about it except for its emotional impact. Then I tried reading Sotweed Factor and Giles Goatboy when he got into his larger mythological style and found it was not for me. And I find that the style in Kimura, I got a little bit into the second one, the Perseus mm-hmm. and Medea, and it just seemed a little too mannered for me. It was very definitely a 70s style that I think has not, for me at least, worn it all well. And if we had time, I could go into a number of other writers who were greatly lauded in the 70s, who I don't think stand up. But I want to give it time. I'm going away for 2 weeks at the end of the month, and I know there's going to be a hammock at the other end. I'm going to take this book along, and under those circumstances, it might be just what I need.
Great.
So that's where we're going to have to stop. Unfortunately, we could have continued. I would have actually liked to talk about this to the end of the hour, but Siddhartha is waiting, so I'm going to call him, and we're going to talk about a New York writer, Paul Auster. So thanks so much, Aaron.
You're welcome, Mac. I'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Booktown, coming toward the end, but we're going to be here for another 13, 14 minutes. I'm Eric Thome, and I'm going to be talking at the last part of this program with our Mumbai correspondent, who we always happen to find in Manhattan instead, Siddhartha Lokanandi. Good afternoon, Siddhartha.
Good afternoon, Eric. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. We had some other things we talked about discussing on this program, you and I hope we still may, including some contemporary Indian novelists.
Absolutely.
When I talked with Erin a couple of weeks ago and suggested that after the four books on her list, we might want to talk about the novelist laureate of Brooklyn, Paul Auster, she deferred to you because I think you are in some ways her literary mentor, and she knows you've read much more than she has. So the first question is, Paul Auster has in some ways a higher reputation in Europe than he does in America, and I think he's there considered one of the great contemporary American novelists. I guess you agree with that.
I agree. I mean, if only for his sheer variedness of his body of work. I mean, he's written fiction, nonfiction, a very heavy dose of poetry, screenplays, autobiography. He's also a movie director. I mean, he's a virtual industry and, you know, powerhouse in some respects, but he's done this through in a very interesting vein, in that he's had similar consistency of topics all throughout his genre. Yeah.
And I've read only four books, and I've read them in the last 8 or 10 months, and they just completely swept me off my feet. I've been waiting to read him, and when I finally got to it, I think I started with two of the high points. Oracle Knight and The Book of Illusions, and they were books I literally could not put down. I just had to finish them, so I put off whatever else I was doing.
Good for you, yeah. I mean, Oracle Knight is a difficult book, I mean, to enter into his aura, but it's one of his singular book that talks about some of the topics that he's obsessed with. I mean, and the eye, you know, he's very much into coincidence and self-consciousness, which is And the eye. And so Oracle Night is a very good example of that.
And also in these two, and I don't know how true this is of some of his others, but it's certainly of these two, he tells stories within stories within stories.
Absolutely.
And you will get caught up. You think you're in a particular world, and then his character will find a notebook and start writing in it. And what he starts writing turns into a completely other world. Or another character starts researching a silent screen comedian, and you get caught up in that person's life for page after page after page. They're melodramatic and soap operaish, but just completely compelling.
Exactly. I mean, I think what makes them so compelling, I think what you allude to is the voice. I mean, it's a melancholic teller of tales, and he loves telling tales. He worships books, movies, anything to do with the imagination. And they almost always, I mean, at least in Oracle Land, Book of Illusions, they almost always struggle with understanding the limits of his language and art, you know, which these are the questions that Paul Auster has been trying to explicate throughout his career. And I think Oracle Land and Book of Illusions, they come to the kind of summa of his, that kind of obsession and also interest in these kinds of questions.
Now, some of the authors that Aaron and I were discussing, like John Barth and John Berger, do this very explicitly. And Auster doesn't. He writes extremely simply, and the questions come up to his characters. There'll be a fascinating point where all of a sudden one of the characters is studying Hawthorne and Melville in the last one I read, and you'll just get two or three pages about that, and it doesn't seem to have any relevance to the story, but it's fascinating in and of itself.
And I think part of the genius of Paul Auster is to make us interested in the things he's interested in. I've read somewhere that he's a huge Hawthorne fan. He loves the way that Hawthorne told stories. And Melville, I mean, I think as any contemporary American writer, self-consciously tries to be like Melville. So these are interesting. So he kind of puts it into his narrative art, the things that make him interested in the narrative, in the art form of writing a book itself, you know. And there's a kind of in his writing, there's an internal investigation of the form of the novel, or what a novel is, what a novel can do, or what a novel, what as a creator, as an author, he can get away with. And I think each time we have to question ourselves what it is that we're reading, and why it is that we read what we read, and how it affects us. So, and for a man to be able to mine that rich vein and to, it's like an infinite sign, you know. He starts somewhere, he goes back and loops in on itself, and the looping goes on, or at least until the physical pages of the book end.
Right, and in those two books, I will have to admit that when he had to bring this whole artifice to an end, when the characters he'd been dealing with, he just sort of tied it up quickly in two pages, and that was it. And I was disappointed in the ending of both books.
I sympathize with you completely. I am also quite disappointed. Well, not disappointed is not the right word. I just don't know, because I do defer to the author's authorial intention to write something the way he wants it to. But when they do, and they do feel like you've been left in the lurch, or, you know, the meal is half, you know, your stomach is half full, I mean. And I don't know what to say about that, to the extent that I think I respect an author to do what he wants. And sometimes if he doesn't quite succeed in satisfying all that we have, maybe it's too much to ask, or something like that.
Now, the next one I read, The Brooklyn Follies, does not go into such extreme storytelling, although there are plots within the plot. You find out what's happening to this character and that character. And so it wasn't quite as, I wasn't quite as mesmerized by it, but I was more satisfied when it ended.
No, and maybe because that's partly because, you know, he's writing about his neighborhood, he's writing about his environment, and Brooklyn Follies followed by a very small amount of time the movie he scripted and directed called Smoke, which is about a smokehouse, and which is about a corner tobacconist tale and the people who come into his life, and it's basically characters come in and walk out and so on. So you only get a brief vein of them, but what you do is that you, because you know he's from Brooklyn, because you know he's writing about the neighborhood he loves very much, you share that love, you share that enthusiasm for him, and so on, and slowly you start to the loves and dislikes of the characters as well. And that's why the book, it might be a kind of a minor attempt, but it's more satisfying emotionally.
Exactly. And then the one after that, Man in the Dark, starts out with one of the most elaborate stories and one of the strangest ones he's told. And then halfway through the book, the person who's imagining it suddenly stops imagining it and returns to his own life. And I found that hugely disappointing because I wanted him to go on with the story. But clearly, he was almost setting that up to then dwell on the emotional resonance between the other two or three characters who were in the house at that time.
Yes. I mean, that book, I mean, I think it was written post-September 11th. Post-September 11th book. So I think he had to make a distinction between the life of the imagination and lived contemporary reality. So I think that's why he steps out of the imagination of the character and into present day and tries to make a distinction, but he doesn't quite succeed. The book was not very well received. I mean, it's seen as a book that all contemporary heavyweight American writers have to write, at least those living in New York.
Mm-hmm.
People like Don DeLillo, whose post-September 11 novel is not a very good one, and Paul Auster also. I mean, I think they all try to grapple with this fairly incredible act of the imagination, as Stockhausen called it, but they all seem to come up short because it so far defies at least a certain amount of fictional understanding of contemporary reality. And I mean, that book, I must say, I really like you, I liked up to the point where the imagination soars, and where when you're reading it, you soon forget that it's about something ghastly,
mm-hmm.
something violent. And then when he brings it back, the ghastliness and violence are so much more insidious and invidious. They really hurt you internally. And you feel like you'd rather not go back to that, because some of us read fiction to escape, you know?
Right.
And this is an escape that was quite remarkably done in a very Austerian way, if I may put it that way. And then when he tries to come back to, you know, mundane affairs of the world, you know, you feel disappointed.
You're right.
Before I leave, I just want to let you know that I think the best way to approach Auster is through the two books that I think are important. Either the New York Trilogy,
mm-hmm.
which are three slim, slim deconstructions of the genre of detective fiction, you know,
mm-hmm.
where, you know, characters meet characters named Paul Auster, the detectives spy on writers who are already spying back on them, and basically chance encounters, a series of coincidences govern the fictional universe and the universe that you and I may know about. They're quite self-conscious, and they explode laterally throughout the trilogy. I mean, that's a good way of approaching Paul Auster as fiction, I think. Or the other way to understanding Paul Auster and what makes him write is his first memoir that he wrote called The Invention of Solitude, which is just a lovely, lovely title. I mean, I only picked up the book partly because of the title. And they're intimate, they're matched, they have their narrative characters are matched with the first-person narrative of the book, you see.
Okay, I'm going to have to cut you off there because we're completely out of time. I'm sorry I didn't call you earlier, and I'm hoping to call you again in a couple of months, and I have a couple of themes that we can talk about between now and then.
We'll be in touch.
Okay, thanks so much. That was Booktown's Mumbai correspondent, Siddhartha Lokanandi, talking to us from Manhattan. And this has been Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and let's get out of here so Jimmy Accardi can do his rock and roll party.